No shit, Vladimir Einstein. The Russian guy looked down after that and the sweat rained off his body like a tropical storm. Fuck that, I thought. I headed for the exit. I was out. I lose. I got a ways to go yet. An hour later, I was doing the Spartan Up podcast with Joe DeSena, the CEO and founder of The Death Race and The Spartan Race. The races include obstacles with the lengths varying from 3 miles to a marathon. They also hold a series of races on military bases. Joe's a trainer, fitness expert, and best-selling author. He's an animal. He's competed in ultramarathons and other long-distance events. 1 year he competed in 50 ultra events and 14 Ironmans. Joe's extreme? I love extreme. We met at a small restaurant on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I got there about 5 minutes early and Joe was already setting up. When I entered, he walked up to greet me carrying his kettlebell. He placed the kettlebell on the floor before he almost hugged last night's Mexican food out of me. The guy carries around a 45-pound kettlebell everywhere he goes. He even brought it on a trip to Japan and had a kung fu master train his 1-year-old son. He told me he does it as a reminder of how comfortable his life is. Once he was situated, it was go time. As we began the podcast, Joe asked me the questions I think everybody will be asking about my stay at the monastery. Why did you go? What did you miss the most? What was it like? What did you get out of it? It turned out Joe was a great interviewer. He asked a lot of straightforward questions, but he got into the nitty-gritty of mental toughness and drive. He could see how this adventure was outside of my skill set since it focused more on slowing down than toughing it out. After an hour, we wrapped the interview and I was on my way. In no time, I was back in Alfredo's car heading north. I punched Newskeet Monastery into the GPS. It told us the trip would take 4 hours and 22 minutes. I was heading back for my last day. Day 16. I'm going home, Mother Monker. Cowards never start. The weak never finish. Winners never quit. Unknown. I got back to the monastery late last night. Late in monk time. By 10 p.m., all the monks were asleep. Monasteries are pretty quiet all the time, but at night, it's disturbingly quiet. It must be clear consciences. In some ways, it felt like I was sneaking in because it was so serene. I was tiptoeing around the place. When I was in high school, my friends would tell me stories about sneaking into their houses when they got home late at night. There was no sneaking in my house. It didn't matter what time I came home, as long as I came home, and my mom was always waiting up on the couch. All personnel had to be accounted for. I think it was about 10:30 p.m. when I finally got settled in my room. For my first 2 weeks at the monastery, I was already in bed by that time. But in just 1.5 days away, my circadian rhythm was back to its old routine. It's not like I was bouncing off the walls like a kid with cake breath jacked up on Coca-Cola, but I was a little fidgety. I packed for the morning. This time, I'm leaving for good. Since I never really unpacked, it didn't take long to stuff the few items I had lying around into my bag. All the fruits and vegetables were gone, so one whole suitcase was basically going home empty. I don't know why I didn't leave from the city yesterday. Maybe I wanted to make sure I'd gotten from the monastery what I needed. Maybe I needed one more day to make it feel more honest and say a proper goodbye, of course. That was necessary. When I sent out the social media blast for book suggestions before I came up here, one of the books someone mentioned was A Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I had already read it, but a long time ago. At night, I had to use a reading glass because of the poor light in the cell, but I read the book twice more during my stay. Frankl wrote it in 1946. He had survived the Auschwitz concentration camp mostly by figuring out what his why was. Most of his fellow prisoners who gave up their will to live had lost their why. Frankl speaks of identifying a positive purpose and creating strong imagery around that outcome. It's a life-changing book, and the lessons can be applied to any life and circumstance. If your why is big enough, the how usually emerges. A big why crushes smaller obstacles every time. I remember when Brother Christopher first asked me about my why. Why was I at the monastery? I didn't have an authentic answer. I didn't want to tell him it was only about writing a book. But now, having spent 2 weeks with the monks, maybe I have a deeper why. For a good portion of my stay, I was figuring out my why, which I think is perfectly acceptable. But I'm not sure if I'd have gotten as much out of it if Brother Christopher hadn't posed the initial question. It echoed in my thoughts throughout my stay and made me push harder. I think it's a question I need to continually ask myself. Why? In business, you ask how and how much. Rarely why. But without a strong why, we're lost. And the why often hides itself. My wife always reminds me that most advertisers talk about the what of a product and not the why. This is a vacuum and it does X, Y, Z, but they don't ever really talk about why you need it or why it was created or why it's different than everything else on the market. It's the why that makes the customer more invested in your product and more emotionally connected. But no one needs to ask me why I'm going home. This morning, after service, I took pictures with all of the monks. We hugged it out and I must have thanked them 37 times and they kept thanking me. I took photos with everybody except Lenny. He doesn't do photos, he told me. As a going away gift, I gave all the monks Atlanta Hawks jerseys. They tried them on and pretended to shoot hoops. Hilarious. It looked nothing like a game of basketball. More like they were swatting flies. And then I spent about an hour cleaning my cell. I swept, mopped the floor with an old towel, and washed the garbage can. It looks exactly like it did 2 weeks ago when I arrived. Before I left, I wanted to make sure I said goodbye to Josh the cook, too. Josh was amazing and really did me a solid smuggling in newspapers. When he reached his hand out to shake before I left, I slipped $300 into his palm as a thank you. At first, he refused it. But after I explained he could use it to treat his young daughter to something, he obliged. Money, money, money. I've learned that money can be a real awkward instrument. It changes relationships. When you don't have any, you can be perceived one way. And when you have a lot of it, you can be perceived in another. It can be intimidating and defining. My mother always used to say to me, "Don't ever borrow money and don't ever lend it. It will only cause problems. If you want to gift it, that's fine. But remember, it's a gift." She could not have been more right. Her one exception to the lending rule was to family. Lastly, I pulled Brother Christopher to the side. I really wanted to thank him for everything he'd done. He made my experience. I gave him the best hug I could, and I felt a spiritual connection to him. But there was something I also really wanted to ask him. "So," I said, "after I get home and talk with my wife, is it okay if I call you up and put our name in for a dog?" "Of course," he said. "You'd be a fantastic dog owner. Any shot we could get bumped up on the waiting list? You know, as a friend of the monks?" "Nope." "Yeah, I didn't think so," I said. "But without asking, you'll never get. You'll be hearing from me. Love you, man." "Okay, then. It's time to close this journal and walk out of my cell for the last time. This is it. I'll write more when I get on the plane." 2 hours later. We got to the airport terminal around 11:35 a.m. I felt calm. I'm excited to see my wife and kids, but it feels very peaceful in and around me. That is until I realized I'd turned my phone off when I meditated in the morning. So I flipped it back on and walked into the airport. Once it powered up, the emails, texts, and social media alerts started coming through in rapid fire, one after another, nonstop. It was actually too much, so I flipped my phone to vibrate and kept walking. Once I checked in, I made my way over to security. I put a cheesecake box and pancake mix I got from the nuns on the moving black conveyor belt and walked through the x-ray machine. That's when the TSA agent stopped the belt.
"What's in the paper bag?" he asked.
"It's cheesecake and pancake mix."
"Cheesecake, huh? Pancake mix, so you say."
"From where?" he said. "The nuns in Nuski."
"You visited the nuns of Nuski?"
"Yes, I live with the monks for a couple of weeks. I'm just leaving now," I said in a soft, almost biblical tone as I stared deep into his eyes. The change in his attitude was remarkable. It was almost as though he wanted to kneel.
"Go right by, sir," he said without even checking the bag.
The cheesecake moved through the x-ray machine without interruption. I could feel the other TSA agents and the rest of the people online looking at me with reverence as if I were a priest. I felt all wise and shit. I had a beard and shaved head. I looked the part. As I got to the other end of the conveyor belt, I was met with smiles and offers of help. Funny, just saying the words Nuski transformed me from a potential drug smuggler to a holy man. The security people treated me like I might be able to help them get into heaven or something. Nuski, the words are magical. Back at Kate's office. When there is no vision, there is no hope. George Washington Carver. I'm heading back to Hachette Book Group. Kate is reading my diary while I take an extended lunch break. She told me to come back in a couple of hours. It's been 2.5. I have no idea what she's going to say or think. But the one thing I've got going for me is it's honest. The diary is the most authentic version of my experience. When I get back into the building and up to the 5th floor, I see Kate sitting in the conference room. Okay, then, it's the moment of truth. I push open the door as she turns to look up at me. She's smiling. I take the seat across from her and the diary is sitting in front of her. It looks like she's read the whole thing. I wait for her to say something, anything. But nothing comes. It's like she's gathering her thoughts. I keep waiting. If we're playing Who Talks First Loses, you aren't gonna win, Kate. I'm trained in silence.
"I think it's great," she says. "There's a lot we can do with this."
"Really?"
"Yes. Just like with Seal, I think people are gonna wanna live vicariously through you, your experience. They're gonna wanna uncover some of the benefits you received from going, things they can apply to their daily lives."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, whenever someone mentions they read Living with the Seal, they usually comment about the 40% rule," she says. "When you think you're done, you're only at 40% of what your body is capable of doing," I interrupt.
"That's powerful," she says, and it really resonated with readers.
"I agree, and I've heard that reaction too," I say. "If people can access that extra 60%, it can make a significant impact on their life. And just knowing the 60% exists can be the difference between finishing and not finishing."
"Exactly," Kate says. "So we need more of that."
"I get it, but I feel like this book isn't as funny as Seal."
"Not every book has to be funny. It has to be genuine," she says. "And I think we need to give the reader what you learned.
Like monk wisdom?"
"Yes," she says, "like what you learned from being up there, or perhaps things you already knew that this experience strengthened. What we need to do is offer something that readers can apply to their daily lives. You know, like
the overall takeaways. We want the reader to be able to feel the way you felt when you left the monastery. And things like Remember Tomorrow are great. I really like that one. That's why people are going to buy your book. And it's your job to deliver. Roger that. Part 3. 10 Real-World Benefits. 1. Hashtag, it's not just a hose. There's nothing so fatal to character as half-finished tasks. David Lloyd George. As I left Kate's office, I thought back on my trip. One of the biggest takeaways from my experience is how much effort the monks put into the small things. Things like making their beds, doing the dishes, and sweeping the floors were given maximum effort. There's an old adage, how you do anything is how you do everything. It's the small things you do during the day that build your character and grit. It's the small things you do that are indications of what you're becoming. As I mentioned, there are various studies pointing to the fact that grit is the number one indicator of future success. So, if we could all be a little more gritty, then we'd all be a bit more successful in all the buckets of our lives. Well, how do we do it? When I got home from the monastery, I was playing with my son Laser outside in our backyard. I had a freezing cold hose flowing and was trying to spray him as he ran back and forth. 10 minutes into our game, Sarah yelled for us to come inside for dinner. After one last spray to the face when my son wasn't looking, I dropped the hose and ran toward the house. I had a full-blown conversation in my head as I headed inside. I told myself it was okay to leave the hose lying on the ground instead of cleaning it up and putting it on the hanger. I'll just do it later, I told myself. No big deal, right? Wrong. That isn't just a hose. That's a reflection of what I am to be. By leaving the hose on the ground and telling myself it's okay and I'll do it later, I'm really telling myself, maybe someone else will do it for me, or it's okay to not finish what I started, or I'll put it off until tomorrow. I'm basically creating an environment in my head that says, it's okay to be lazy. It's okay to not be a finisher. It's okay to put things off. Those little moments happen multiple times a day for us. It's these small things that the monks excelled at. There was not an ounce of laziness or procrastination at Newskeet. By consistently doing things you may not want to do, you create an environment in your head that says you're okay doing hard things. You're training yourself to go through obstacles rather than let them deter you. The other side of the conversation in my head was saying, Jesse, pick up the hose, roll it in a circle, and put it on the hanger. Finish what you started. Complete the task. You're a finisher. How you do anything is how you do everything. It's not just a hose. So I marched back outside, coiled the hose, and put it away properly. I felt good about myself. The backyard looked clean. My shit was in order. I stood there for a moment admiring my backyard, and then splat. A perfectly thrown water balloon delivered from my son smacked me in the head. Well played, Laser. Well played. 2. Hashtag 28,470 days. Time is what we want the most, but what we use worst. William Penn. One of the first things I became aware of on day one at the monastery was my relationship with time. I had hints of it on Mount Washington, but sitting in my cell on the first night, I quickly figured out that I was going to be there for a total of 1,286,000 seconds, and it freaked me out. I realized I had a lot of time on my hands. Or did I? The average American male lives to be about 78 years old, and I'm 49 at the writing of this book. That means, if I'm average, I have about 10,495 days left. Since I sleep roughly one-third of those days, I really have 7,871 days. That's nothing. That's only 29 summers, and I love summers. When we think about relationships, we often think in terms of people. How is our relationship with our parents, friends, spouses, kids? We rarely think about our relationship with time, and for many of us, myself included, that relationship is often out of balance. I started to do some math, and it put time in perspective. My parents are 88 years old, and I see them about 4 times a year. Well, if they live to be 92, I hope they live much longer, then that would mean I only have 16 more times to see them. That's unacceptable. When you put time in perspective, you realize what's important and you reprioritize things. I immediately booked a flight to see them. The monastery was a huge hourglass for me. When you sit in your cell for hours at a time with silence and no distractions, you realize how slowly time can go. But when you live in the big city and live super fast, you often look up one day and your kids are all grown. And that's when you realize how fast time has gone. How many days do you have left? How do you want to spend them? And whom do you want to spend them with? As I get older, these are the questions that become more and more important to me, and I continue to gain an appreciation for urgency. If you can't live longer, live deeper. Italian proverb. 3. Hashtag the best have a process. Plans are worthless, but planning is everything. Dwight D. Eisenhower. While I was shadowing the monks at the dog training center, it became eminently clear I was around greatness. The monks of Newskeet are among the best in the world at dog training. It's not up for debate. And watching it firsthand was fascinating. The dogs arrived for their first day of training as complete misfits and left valedictorians of doggy school. One thing I knew before I ever stepped foot on the monastery was, if you're surrounded by greatness, take notes, pay attention, and ask questions. I learned this by accident. 25 years ago, I assumed what it took to be a great musician was different from what it took to be a great chef or a great gymnast. I didn't think there was a blueprint for greatness, but I was wrong. In 2001, my partner and I started a private jet card company called Marquee Jet. It wasn't easy, but we grew the company to the largest private jet card company in the world. And despite the success, the greatest gift the Marquee Jet ever gave to me was being around so many people who were the best in the world at what they do. We flew all-star athletes, the most successful entrepreneurs, and world-renowned doctors. I spent hours up in the air with them chatting and picking their brains. I'd always ask them about their daily routines. What do you do first thing in the morning? Or how do you manage your time? I wanted to gain insight into what makes the greatest in their fields tick. It was during these discussions I uncovered several traits that so many of these industry leaders had in common. For starters, virtually all of them developed a process that works best for them over time. Seal has a process. Warren Buffett has a process. The Rolling Stones have a process. And the monks definitely have a process similar to all of the other greats I've ever interacted with. Here's a glimpse of theirs. A. The monks get up early. The day started before sunrise. By the time I greeted them in church for the morning service, most of them had already tended to their dogs, meditated, and reviewed their tasks for the day. When I asked Brother Stavros why they do this, he told me the one race he always likes to win is the race against the sun rising. Like so many of the greats in every field, mornings are magical for the monks. When I got home, I started getting up around 5 a.m. and going for quiet jogs. There was never anybody outside in my neighborhood in the early morning. I take pride in what I was doing and say to myself, there are 7 billion people on earth, and I'm the only one up and on these streets? Beat the sun, beat your competition. Try it. B. The monks have a plan. Every night before they went to sleep, they wrote a plan for the next day. They were organized. They prioritized the important things that had to get done first and focused on completing those tasks until they went on to the next. There was no guessing as to what had to get done that day. Every day had a plan, and the plan had to be executed. I hear this theme a lot. A goal without a plan is just a wish. C. The monks are efficient. There was very little dilly-dallying during the day. Time was sacred. I didn't see any small talk or chatter around the monastery. The monks executed with a focus that was laser sharp. I think about all the time I've spent in the gym talking to my trainer or walking around thinking about what I have to do next. If I added all that wondering time up, it'd equal weeks of wasted downtime. The monks maximized the day. D. The monks don't get flustered. When Brother Stavros's car got stuck in the snow, there was no panic. Nobody called AAA to come help. The monks circled everyone up and we pushed the car out of the snow. While it may not seem like a big deal, it's the way they approached the problem that struck me as noteworthy. They were calm and deliberate in all their problem solving. Nobody was mad, upset, or frustrated. They had to fix the problem and worked as a team to get it done. One theme I've seen in so many of the great entrepreneurs, parents, and coaches is they don't panic. They operate well under pressure. 4. Hashtag happiness test. Happiness isn't something you experience. It's something you remember. Oscar Levant. Within the first 30 minutes of stepping foot on the monastery, Brother Christopher asked me if I was happy. And I felt pretty confident that happiness was not one of the things I was searching for at the time. I had it already. I am happy. A friend recently told me that I was the happiest person he'd ever met. But Brother Christopher also said something that resonated. He believes too many people, wittingly or unwittingly, constrict their happiness. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there was no lid on happiness, he asked. Yes. Yes, it would be. So he got me thinking. How do you lift the lid on happiness? Just after he'd won the Nobel Prize, Albert Einstein was staying at a hotel in Japan. When the bellboy brought up his luggage, he realized he didn't have any money. So he found a piece of scrap paper and wrote his theory of how to have a happy life. He handed it to the bellboy as a tip. The note read, "A calm and modest life brings more happiness than the pursuit of success combined with constant restlessness." In this day and age, living calmly is a lot easier said than done. What I learned from the monks is that you can find calmness during your day, and small doses of calmness can open a door to happiness. And with all due respect to Albert E., I think that you can pursue happiness just as you pursue success. Not too long ago, I was preparing for a speech I had to give. I was basically writing it in my head while I ran 10 miles. Somewhere around mile 3, I started to wonder if there was a scale to gauge happiness. There are myriad ways to measure other key areas of our lives. Weight is measured by stepping on a scale. Income measured by a tax bracket, an IQ test for intelligence, but there's no simple way to quantify happiness. With each stride, the idea developed. We spend endless hours doing things that make us happy, but invest much less time working on changing the things that make us unhappy. I'd much rather watch a football game, which makes me happy, than tackle difficult issues about myself, which can make me unhappy. So later that night, I was on stage in front of 1,000 highly successful people. These were folks who owned their own businesses and had a high net worth. On paper, this pool of people would most likely check the happiness box. So I posed this question. Think about all the buckets in your life, your health, your relationships, work, finances, etc., everything. Now, on a scale of 1 through 10, with the Dalai Lama being a 10 out of 10 on the happiness scale and the guy who's at rock bottom being a 1? What is your happiness number? After 30 seconds, I said, no need to put any one person on the spot. Let's do it this way. Everyone who is a 7 or less, please stand up. Remarkably, almost everyone in the room rose to their feet. 1,000 highly successful CEOs and industry leaders scored themselves a 7 or less. A 7 out of 10 sounds pretty good, right? I said into the microphone. But if your child came home with a 70 on their math test, that's a C minus. If your number was a 6, that's 60%, and that's an F in the most important bucket of your life, happiness. I was shocked how so many people in the audience initially seemed perfectly content with a 7. They didn't realize they were going through life under-indexing in this category. What's amazing about this test, however, is not your score, but what you identify by doing it. When you take this test, your brain automatically starts at a 10. It wants you to be happy. Then it immediately subtracts the 2 to 3 biggest things in your life that are making you unhappy. Try it. The issues contributing to your unhappiness literally appear in your head, automatically. It can be anything. Being overweight, having no money, an unhealthy relationship, a crappy job. The first 2 to 3 things that popped into your head are the things blocking you from being happier. Remove 1, and your happiness grades out at a B. Remove 2, and you go to the top of the class. Identifying what keeps you from being happier is the first step. When you begin working to remove the obstacles, you are taking the next steps to an A+. I already knew what made me happy, family, working out, challenging myself, but by meditating, monotasking, and otherwise clearing the clutter in my mind, the monks taught me how to see what made me unhappy. Too many distraction and intrusions, infringements on my time, and that showed me what I needed to change. Identify and improve. Identify and improve. It's kind of simple if you just allow it, but it starts with the one question Brother Christopher asked me. Are you happy? 5. Hashtag dodge the arrows. Do it over and over again until it becomes part of who you are. Unknown. Interestingly enough, one of the best things I learned at the monastery wasn't from one of the monks. It was from a dog. Remember when I was trying to distract Rainbow while she was being trained? Like most of us, Rainbow was easily distracted when she started her training. Her natural inclination was to react to whatever stimuli she encountered on her path. A squirrel runs by, every fiber in her furry body wants to dart after it. Another dog? How in the hell can you expect her to pass that up? Her reaction is instinctual, but not all instincts are helpful. Brother Thomas trained Rainbow to completely ignore the interferences coming her way that may distract her from her goal. I'm training the dog to block out the noise and keep going, he explained. This isn't unlike our own lives where most of our goals get shattered because we don't block out the noise. We're not trained to ignore the distractions. We listen to naysayers. We get pulled in multiple directions and sidetracked by trivial things. And ultimately, if enough of those distractions pile up, we fall short of our goals. In my life, I call my distractions arrows, and I didn't realize how bombarded I was by them until I stepped away from it all. I realized how under attack I am daily. On any given day, I'm dodging unessential requests for my time, my own negative thoughts and life circumstances, and they come from all directions. I find that many of the personal requests we get are one-sided agendas. People who want something from us. Don't get me wrong, I've been on that side of the equation and imposed on people to help me get ahead in life. I know the importance of making connections. And I also understand the importance of helping those behind you on the ladder to success. But if you say yes to too many of those requests, it takes time away from your goals. The arrows also fly toward us in personal challenges. Say you're training for a race and your training plan calls for early morning runs. Well, it's cold in the morning. It may be snowing. It's dark outside. Those are all arrows. Those are reasons to not get out there. It's important that when these arrows appear, you acknowledge them for what they are. One of the keys to accomplishing a big goal is to avoid the obstacles. Dodge the arrows. Lastly, there are the arrows that come at you as part of everyday life. Your toilet overflows, the car won't start, the boss is being a dick again. Though these distractions might be unavoidable, they don't have to deter you from your goal. Sometimes the arrows are things that you don't have. You want to take a vacation, but you don't have the money. You want to start a business, but you don't have the experience. Or you want to take a class, but you don't have the time. These type of arrows stop you dead in your tracks, but they don't have to. Rainbow doesn't stop walking because she doesn't own any food. She just keeps on going and has the faith there's food somewhere down the line. When I watched Rainbow walk with Brother Thomas, there was no denying she was happy. Her whole body sprang with purpose. But learning to not react to something so instinctual took practice and wasn't easy. If you have a goal, don't get caught up in the distractions. You have to shut off all the noise coming at you to be successful. Rainbow had to train like a dog, and so do we. 6. Hashtag go where you think best. Thinking. The talking of the soul with itself. Plato. I really believe thinking is a lost art form. Today, we get answers on demand from Google, Siri, and Alexa. If you're listening to this in audio format, Alexa probably just turned herself on. But many of us don't invest any real time into thinking. Yet, giving ourselves time to think is one of the best investments we can make. And there's no risk. The night at the monastery when Brother Christopher told me to think for the next 12 hours, I was at a loss. At the time, my thinking was a scattershot process that took up too much of my mental energy. I was overwhelmed. But over the course of 2 weeks, I thought about thinking mostly because I was forced into it. There was little else to do. I found myself alone for a lot of my stay. But in the real world, I have to find time to be alone, and I have to find a place I'm comfortable alone, a place where I like to be alone. If I don't exercise my thinking muscle, it goes away and I don't think clearly. My wife thinks best in her car. We live 2 miles from her office, which is a 10-minute drive, but Sarah has created a 40-minute fake commute so she can think. I wonder if she thought of that idea while driving in the car. She set up cameras in her vehicle so she can say all of her thoughts out loud while driving and not worry about forgetting them. For me, it's running or walking. I recently calculated I've run almost every day for the past 25 years. Almost 36,000 miles, which is like walking around the circumference of the earth 1.5 times. That's like 9,000 hours alone. It's when I do my best thinking, pounding the pavement or the path or the track. Without it, I don't think I'd have had nearly the same success in my life. It's like a forced meditation for me. That's why I choose to run without music. I can clear my mind by listening to my footfalls, and usually within a few miles, I'm in sync with my body and spirit. I'm totally focused and in stride with the world around me. Everything is clear. I've come up with stuff like Halloween costumes for the family, written entire speeches for speaking engagements, solved work problems, figured out the best way to make amends, and created new ideas for business ventures, all while running. And as soon as I finish, I immediately write them down in one notebook. Putting it on paper declutters your head and frees up energy. I've learned that when you're in the zone, stay there. If you're thinking clearly, then keep it going. Extend the session. That's when it's time to go for a longer run. One day, not too long after I got back from the monastery, I called Turney and asked him how he was doing. We went back and forth for a bit, and then he launched into how he was battling writer's block for an article he was working on. How nothing was coming to him, how he couldn't get the words on the page, and that his day was a big fat zero. He was defeated and felt like he couldn't recover. "Turney," I said, "where do you come up with your best ideas, solve problems, figure things out? Where is that?"
He said, "on the toilet?"
"Well then," I said, "sit on the fucking toilet." He called me 30 minutes later and said, "problem solved." Brother Christopher and all the other monks made me think about thinking. It's a skill, a craft, and an art. It can be worked on and improved with practice. We all have an opportunity to become better thinkers. Go where you think best and spend more time there. 7. Hashtag monotask. The successful warrior is the average man with laser-like focus. Bruce Lee. The first time Brother Stavros asked me to wash the dishes, it was right after the retreat, and I wanted to know what the record time was for cleaning them all. "Work with your hands and pray with your heart," he said. Wait, what? I had no idea what he was talking about, and I had no time for riddles. I had dishes to do and records to break. I flipped on the water and grabbed the sponge. The monks had served lunch to over 100 people, so I started flying. I was washing, drying, and washing, drying, and stacking like a one-man car wash assembly line. Dishes, pots, glasses, whatever they had, I was washing it. I would have washed a monk if he were standing next to me. Every time I thought I was making progress, another monk came in with a handful of dirty dishes. Then I got a cookie tray stuck, wedged in between the sinks. It was messing with my record pace. Plus, my lower back was killing me. And while I was doing the dishes, I was thinking about my afternoon chores, the time I had left, how cold it was, etc. I was doing it wrong. I wasn't doing it like a monk. During my stay, I wondered how the monks have such great energy and effort. They're so efficient in everything they do. The answer is they monotask. That's how they do it. And they do it with perfection. The monks do their jobs with zest, but only one dish at a time. Each dish is done like the world depends on it. Maybe it does. They're completely singularly focused. There are no distractions. They don't increase their effort. They increase their concentration. A task is never a race, and there's never a finish line. There is only now. Me? I'm all over the map. I don't get the same effort. We live in a world of to-do lists. We're overwhelmed, short-circuiting, and it becomes so intimidating to get things done. Sometimes, I don't know where to start, and the natural reaction is to do everything. Let me try to get it all done, but I'll leave a task with a promise. I'll get back to it later. When I take on a task, I want to finish it as quickly as possible so I can tackle the next. For me, everything is a race. I thought what was important was doing as much as I could in a day. I was focused on the quantity, not the quality. The monks live in a world of quality. No task is left half done, and each task is done to the best of their ability. Monotasking brings better effort, results, and satisfaction. When Brother Gregory brought in another load of dishes, I asked him how many more I'd have to do. "You only have to do one," he said, "just the one you're holding in your hand." For most of my adult life, I've tried to be an excellent multitasker, but not anymore. Nope. I try to monotask multiple times a day. 8. Hashtag, make a contract with yourself. When there is no enemy within, the enemies outside cannot hurt you. African proverb. As we were hiking up a paved road and talking, Brother Thomas told me the 4 vows all of the monks take when they join the monastery. Definitely not giving up sex was my first thought when he mentioned the chastity vow. But it made me realize the importance of establishing and honoring your own non-negotiables. And the monk's strict rules gave me the idea to have my own set of vows. So on the last night at the monastery, I decided to write a contract with myself, a list of how I wanted to live my life. I read it to myself every morning, and it's been helpful in guiding me during the day. This exercise takes only a second, and the benefits are long-lasting. Here is my contract with myself. I'm going to thank God first thing in the morning. I'm going to show appreciation for having this day. Today, I'm going to be the best version of me that I can be. I'm going to try hard at whatever it is I do. I'm going to be present and patient. I'm going to be a teacher to my kids. I'm going to be a good son, brother, and friend. I'm going to be giving to my wife. I have signed many contracts in my life, but never one with myself. It feels good to write one, and even better to keep it. 9. Hashtag experience is overrated. Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. Soren Kierkegaard. It turns out the nuns built their home in 1971. They took a woodshop class in town and learned how to construct a house. They also made many of the desks and tables they use on a daily basis. When I asked how they accomplished all that without any experience, Sister Cecilia said, "Necessity is the mother of invention." You know when you hear someone say something and it feels like they knocked it out of the park? Well, at that point, I was looking at Sister Cecilia like she was Aaron Judge and she just drove one deep over the center field wall in Yankee Stadium. Wow. No truer words have been spoken. Necessity is the mother of invention. And the monks went into the dog breeding business without any practical experience. In fact, the only experience they had collectively with dogs was Kier, the original dog they had as a pet. And yet, they were able to grow into one of the most renowned German Shepherd breeding programs in the United States. And they went on to become world-famous dog trainers and the authors of multiple New York Times best-selling dog training books. All of that without any experience. They're not the only ones. Richard Branson, Thomas Edison, Colonel Sanders, Rachel Ray, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, and Oprah all have something in common. They became incredibly successful in fields in which they had no experience. I could give you example after example of people in business, sports, and life who succeeded spectacularly without experience. My wife Sarah is another great example. How did they do it? Well, maybe the most important ingredient to their success was they didn't waste time thinking they couldn't succeed. Negativity stops dreams. It's like the antithesis of a dream catcher. Even if you're not brimming with confidence, try to keep your thoughts positive. I like to have the end of the movie, my goal, in my head, and then fill in the script as I go. Even if the script requires rewrites, the goal stays the same. Act as if you're going to succeed, and chances are you will. The monks didn't walk around saying, "I don't know anything about carpentry. I don't know how to breed dogs." What they said was, "It's a good idea to have a monastery, and breeding dogs would be a good way to make money." And then they just went about trying their best. Maybe the best part of having no experience is it's quicker than getting experience. If Sarah had gone to business school, studied the garment manufacturing business, and then taken a course in product labeling to come up with the name Spanx, it'd have taken her half a lifetime. And by then, someone else might have come up with the idea or She might have begun to believe the negative thoughts that everyone has in their heads. Instead, she just jumped in. When you immerse yourself in an idea you're passionate about and on full alert, every cell of your body becomes a fully engaged receptor of the stimuli that surrounds us. It's like when Seal had me jump into a frozen lake. I was instantly more alert than I ever had been, and my survival instincts kicked in and were razor sharp. The other thing about entering into a new business or even a relationship without experience, you engage your instinctual drive to survive. For the monks, it was do or die. When the monks started their breeding business, they read every book on dog breeding they could get their hands on, and then they read them again. They called breeders across the country and asked for help. They did the same thing when they started training dogs. I'm convinced one of the best ways to learn is to be self-taught. You can't get away with cutting corners or slacking off when you're both teacher and student. Experience is overrated. It takes too long. If you're moved to do something, do it. The last thing you need to worry about is you've never done it before. Most of us want to wait until we either have the right amount of experience or feel it's the right time to tackle something. That right time rarely comes. So yeah, when Sister Cecilia said, necessity is the mother of invention, I totally got it. 10. Hashtag build your edge. The past is where you learn the lessons. The future is where you apply the lessons. Unknown. When I left the monastery, Alfredo asked me how I felt. I assumed he was expecting a response like focused or calm or maybe even relaxed. But that's not what I was feeling. I'm proud, I said. As we drove away, I sat there strapped in the seatbelt and took a long sigh, and then I smiled, a proud smile. I knew I was going home successful. I put the challenge in front of me, tried to build on it, and hung in until it was completed. I was proud I had the courage to come to the monastery, stick it out, and give my best effort. Effort is the true source of pride, not results. I once heard a guest on my friend Lewis Howe's podcast say that every day he wakes up and tells himself, today, I'm going to try my hardest at everything I do. And then, at the end of each day before he goes to sleep, he asks himself, did I indeed try my best today? If the answer is yes to both questions, then he considers it a hell of a day. Think about it. We can't always control the outcome, the results. But we can always control our effort. I believe trying our best every day is a great way to measure success. The monk's daily effort is unrivaled, contagious, and super successful. Every day is about doing the best they can regardless of the task. Do you just want to make your bed? Or do you want to make your bed like a monk? There's a big difference between the two. Once I started to really understand the monk's determination, I started to feel a shift in my thinking. While I was at the monastery, it inspired me to make a pledge to spend as much time as possible around people who are focused on effort. I want to continue pushing forward this element in my life. Effort is everything. I want to be around people who don't cut corners and feel proud at the end of each day. I may not share all of the beliefs the monks have, but you can't question their discipline. Their energy is infectious and inspiring. And because of their effort, the monks have edge. Edge is an internal advantage. It's the right hook that your brain can use to knock out fear or that internal bully when it creeps into your thoughts. When you gain edge, it's like stamping a permanent I get shit done tattoo on your brain. You can always access it when needed. And you get edge by stepping into the unknown and by consistently doing things that are hard. My edge in life has primarily come through challenging myself physically. It's a different kind of edge than the monks. And I'm often asked why I like challenges so much. Maybe it's because I learned something about myself every time, or maybe it's because I'm an adrenaline junkie. But when I get a good look under my own hood, I'm able to use that experience for future endeavors. My past challenges have given me a confidence and swagger that I can't get from reading a book, listening to a speaker, or attending a conference. The challenges have taught me about accessing my own courage. The same courage it takes to start a business or quit a job or take any kind of risk. When I pulled up to the monastery, I had a nervous pit in my stomach. The same feeling I get before a big meeting or standing at the starting line of a marathon. I was scared of the unknown that was ahead. I was nervous of what could happen, what would happen. But I also knew that those same feelings meant a growth opportunity was on the horizon. And on the last day when I left, I knew I had gained another layer of edge, the monk's edge. This experience was an edge enhancer. Thanks, monks. Part 4. The New Beginning. Adding to my life resume. After I left Kate's office, I hustled to LaGuardia Airport. I wanted to catch the next flight back to Atlanta. The meeting with my editor was positive and productive, but I'm still not 100% sure I have a book. I'm missing something, and I need time to figure out what that something is. On the plane, I take out a pen in my diary and flip it to a blank page and start to write. Things I like about monks. 1. Monks do one thing at a time. 2. Monks don't rush. They do things slowly and deliberately. 3. Monks don't cut corners. They do it completely. 4. Monks do less, but do more. 5. Monks remain calm. They don't panic. 6. Monks are okay being alone. They thrive at it. 7. Monks study all different kinds of topics to enhance growth. 8. Monks devote time to sitting. 9. Monks smile. 10. Monks live simply. 11. Monks don't waste time. 12. Monks have a strong community and family unit. 13. Monks have a love affair with life. The plane starts to taxi and we slowly make our way to the runway. There's got to be a creative way to tell this story. I've got to find a monk-like way. The flight attendants make their final pass down the aisle, reminding everyone to fasten their seatbelts. I close the diary and put it under my seat. Eventually, the captain tells us we're next for takeoff. I have a lot of work to do, but I'm going to wait until I can go where I think best. The next evening, I'm on a run in our neighborhood. It's unseasonably warm, so I'm thinking 10 miles sounds good. As I run, I begin thinking about the monks. I wonder what they're doing. They're probably in the church singing to kick off the nightly service. Lenny's probably lighting the incense. I keep running. As my mind clears, I realize I'm focused only on the rhythmic beat of my feet slapping the concrete. Everything else has drifted away. It feels just like meditating. Then, out of nowhere, the conversation with Kate replays in my thoughts, and with it comes the structure of my book. I'll just write it the same way I told her the story. That's it. The Mount Washington adventure plays in my head. I see myself with Kevin the cop at the top of the mountain. That's it. That's it. Like most great spiritual journeys, this one starts on a mountaintop. I race home. Sweating, heart beating, still in my shorts and t-shirt, I plop down in my chair and begin to outline. I access my inner monk and monotask. My goal is to write every day and get one chapter done a week. I create a pie chart of my 24 hours in a day and carve out 3 to 4 hours for writing. In that time, the only thing I'm allowing myself to do is work on the book. My office door is closed, the phone is turned off, and so is my Wi-Fi. I remove all possible and potential distractions from my task at hand.